It's time for Gervie's Law, the intersection of law and life, with your host, injury compensation attorney, author, and mentor, Alan Gervie. Alan is managing attorney at the law firm of Rowan Gervie & Wynn, a workers' compensation law firm who have represented injured workers for over 35 years. Joined today by his co-host, radio personality and television host, Carrie Kasem. Carrie brings a fresh, real perspective to the intersection of law and life, turning Murphy's Law upside down. And now, here are Alan Gervie and Carrie Kasem.
A good afternoon, Los Angeles, and all of you listening on the internet on KBC.com. I am Alan Gervie, and I am the managing partner of the law firm of Rowan Gervie and Wynn. And today, as usual, I am here, right here on Talk Radio 790 KBC, to be the managing partner of your life. And as usual, of course, I always introduce my co-host right here, sitting beside me, Carrie Kasem. But today, unfortunately, I won't be able to do that because Carrie is not sitting beside me. Carrie is on assignment for Gervie's Law at the AMA Awards. Actually, it's not for Gervie's Law. She is doing an assignment on the red carpet of the AMA Awards, which take place tomorrow right here in L.A., and we will get an update from her next week on our Thanksgiving show on how it all went at the AMA Music Awards. Today, though, we have an incredible show. We really do, folks. I'll tell you, it was an exciting week in criminal law this week. We saw all kinds of things happening. We heard from Charlie Sheen, of course, and good old Jared Fogle. He got sentenced. And we've got some important other events coming up in criminal law in the next few weeks, where there's going to be a hearing in the Suge Knight case. And who better to be sitting in my co-host's chair, Carrie Kasem's chair, today, none other than the Tom Mesereau. And Tom Mesereau, as you probably all know, represented Michael Jackson in the child molestation charges. And of course, he was successful with that. He's represented Robert Blake, Mike Tyson, and a host of other people. He is one of the good guys in law. Tom Mesereau, welcome to Gervie's Law.
Alan, thank you for having me. Really appreciate it.
It's great to have you, and I'm grateful that we have an hour together. And of course, you are sitting in Carrie's chair, and I was saying before we went on the air that your hair is probably second to Carrie as the greatest hair in this studio today.
But mine's dyed, you know that.
It's dyed. Yeah. That's a great
dyed gray.
Great color.
Just kidding.
I love the color. And you've been known for your hair through the years on CNN and on all the radio, television outlets in the media. Everyone knows Tom Mesereau with these great locks, the flowing gray locks.
Well, I was interviewed by Barbara Walters after the Michael Jackson victory.
Right.
And I didn't know how she was going to start the interview. And she started off by saying, Where do you get your hair?
She was probably jealous because, you know, when you look at Barbara Walters' hair, it's always perfect. It looks like it's got so much hairspray on it, and yours is just cool.
Well, thank you.
But let's talk about Barbara Walters. You were named one of the 10 most fascinating people in 2005 by Barbara Walters, as well as being Man of the Year for GQ Magazine in 2005.
Well, that was a big year for me.
It was a big year.
That was the year of the Michael Jackson trial. It was about 5 months. I spent 6 months in northern Santa Barbara County preparing for the trial and then conducting the trial. I was Michael's lead criminal defense lawyer, and it was an exhausting trial. It went 5 days every week. And, of course, the stakes were very high. More media covered the case than O.J. Simpson and Scott Peterson combined.
Right.
And we prevailed 14 not guilties, 10 felonies and 4 misdemeanors. And it was a big year for me. And after that, I was given a lot of awards, asked to speak around the country. And Barbara Walters did name me one of her 10 most fascinating people. And I was shocked when I got the letter from her. But the letter that she sent me said, it's not just because of the Jackson victory. It's because of work you do in poor communities and at free legal clinics and in the Deep South and that kind of thing. So it was a great event for me and a great opportunity.
You know, we have so much to talk about in Gervie's Law right here. But I just want to say, I am so proud of you, being a lawyer myself, that you can be honored by Barbara Walters, GQ Magazine. These are outlets that typically are not honoring lawyers for not only, you know, their great looks and their great smile, those dimples are melt people, I'm sure. But at the same time, obviously, for the contributions you've made in the legal arena.
Well, I remember when I was first interviewed by Michael Jackson about whether or not I should be his criminal defense lawyer. He was unhappy with his prior counsel and definitely was going to fire the lawyers that were representing him. And I went to Florida secretly and met with him. Randy Jackson, his brother, arranged it. And he wanted to know about my view of the legal profession and how I conducted my life. And I told him that I had tried doing the so-called right things. I was with a big, prestigious civil law firm in Washington, D.C., and then I was a prosecutor briefly, and then I was assistant to the president of a large corporation for a couple of years, monitoring law firms around the country, what they did. And I told him that all of it was interesting and none of it was fulfilling long-term. And I just really wanted to find a passion for something, and I said I began volunteering at free legal clinics in South Central Los Angeles at African-American churches.
Right.
And one thing led to another. I began doing pro bono capital murder defense cases in the South. And I told him that this really brought fulfillment and passion and real enjoyment to me as a lawyer. And I remember when I walked out of that interview, I said, I'm probably the last guy he's going to hire. He must think I'm a real strange dude.
Right.
You know?
And that didn't happen, of course, because he did hire you.
He did.
It really begs the question of a guy. You're a Harvard guy. You went to Harvard College. You end up doing this pro bono work. And, of course, you've worked for the First AME Church in L.A. And you've been doing, what, a capital crime, a murder trial in Alabama. You call them the Deep South clients every year. How does a Harvard guy get into being the hero for a lot of African Americans in their communities?
Well, I think it's a question of, you know, step by step going through life, trying to figure out where you are at each stage and trying to decide, you know, what you want to do. I got out of law school and wasn't quite sure where I belonged. My father was a West Point graduate. He never went to law school and always wished he had. And he always said to me, if you don't really know what you want to do, give it strong consideration because it does provide a lot of options.
Right.
And he was absolutely correct. The problem is a lot of lawyers have very, in my opinion, stilted imaginations. You know, they get out of law school, they try a job, they don't like it, they switch to another firm. It's really the same job with another wrapping.
Exactly.
And they keep doing this and then they give up. They should try something radically different. You know, we can be criminal defense lawyers, we can be transactional lawyers, we can have our own practice, we can work at medium firms, large firms, the government. I mean, there's so many things we can do, and we can keep trying to find the passion that makes life so worthwhile if we keep trying, but a lot of them don't. I think a law degree is a wonderful degree. I speak at public schools all the time and try to encourage kids to not only go to college, but consider being lawyers. And a lot of these public school kids in L.A. will look at me like, nobody ever told me that. You think I can be a lawyer? I said, of course you can be a lawyer. I remember one charter school I spoke at years ago. It was a school where kids had been thrown out of every, you know, it was the last rung. I mean, the last school that would take them. And a lot of them with problems with criminal conduct, with all sorts of behavioral problems. And a young African-American girl came up to me and said, you think I could be a lawyer? I said, I know you could be a lawyer. I can already tell you'd be a great one. She showed me bullet scars on her forearms and her shins where she had survived drive-by shootings. And she said nobody had ever told her she could be good at anything. And I said, you could be great. I know it. Now, what's happened to her, I don't know. But you gotta give people a sense that they have value, that they really count.
And aren't you thankful to your father when you think about it way back when he encouraged you? And a lot of kids don't get that encouragement from someone from West Point, for instance.
No, they don't. And I think we're so blessed to have the degree we have, to have the options we have. I think we have to give back. And I truly try to encourage lawyers, go to public schools in the inner city, tell kids about college, about law school, encourage them that they can make a big difference in society and that a law degree gives you freedom that other degrees don't give you. And you'll be surprised what a difference you make. And, you know, and life is tough and people want to make money and they have bills to pay.
Right.
And to convince them to do something that's not lucrative or doesn't pay you anything is not always an easy sell. But it comes back. It really
does.
You know,
I'll tell you, when you say it comes back, next week, don't miss Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KBC. We are doing our special Thanksgiving show, and we have three attorneys on the show who are with the Los Angeles Trial Lawyers Charities. These are attorneys who are giving back to the community, just like Tom is talking about. And we're going to talk about how sometimes lawyers get a bad name, but there are so many of us out there who really care and are trying to give back, being appreciative of what they have.
There really are. As I say, unfortunately, a lot of lawyers are so caught up in paying the bills and living the appearances they want to show everybody else that they lose track of just what power they have to affect young people's lives. We can do a lot in the community, and I certainly try to do my best.
And Dana Cole, who you've worked with extensively, said the following: Michael Jackson has always been impressed with the pro bono work and contributions Tom has made in the African American community. And that may have been one of the reasons why Michael Jackson chose you. We're going to talk a little bit more about the Michael Jackson case and, of course, the Suge Knight case. We're going to get your opinion on Charlie Sheen potentially looking at criminal actions down the road and what happened with Jared Fogle this week. We have to take a quick break. We will be back right after this. You're listening to Gervie's Law. We have Tom Mesro right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Any person who makes or causes to be made any knowingly false or fraudulent material statement or material representation for the purposes of obtaining workers' compensation benefits is guilty of a felony.
Another day at work. The pain is getting worse, and I'm afraid to say anything because I need this job, and I don't want to get fired. If I wasn't the only one supporting the family, I'd quit.
Is this you? Are you suffering every day while your injuries get worse, and there seems to be nowhere to turn? Or do you have an injury that was brought on gradually by repetitive motion, and now you can't perform your job duties at all? For over 35 years, the law firm of Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn has represented those who have sustained an injury on the job or have become disabled as a result of work. They're the experts in workers' compensation. You need an advocate. You need someone who cares about the injured worker. You need the law firm of Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn to get you through the nightmare. Friends, if you're suffering with a cumulative work injury, the law firm of Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn is in business to help you. Find out more. Call the law firm of Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn, 855-4-RGW-LAW. That's 855-4-RGW-LAW. Or go to rgwlawfirm.com. First consultations are free.
Call Quicken Loans now at 800-QUICKEN to see if you qualify for the government's Home Affordable Refinance Program, or HARP. And for 5 years in a row now, J.D. Power has ranked Quicken Loans highest in the nation in customer satisfaction. And for the second year in a row, they've also ranked us highest in mortgage servicing. Call 800-QUICKEN or visit quickenloans.com.
Visit jdpower.com for award information. Call for cost information and conditions. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumeraccess.org, number 3030.
Comfort means a state of feeling satisfied, and at thecompanystore.com, your comfort is our number one priority. For more than 100 years, the Company Store has handcrafted in the U.S. the very best bedding basics, unique items you won't find anywhere else, like our dual warmth comforters that keep you and your partner sleeping at just the right temperature. Bring comfort home today. Thecompanystore.com, 20% off your entire order plus free shipping with code RADIO at checkout. TheCompanyStore.com. We are all about comfort.
Welcome back to Gervie's Law, turning Murphy's Law upside down on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Great choice of music. Little Jackson 5, Michael Jackson. So, yeah, you are listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KBC. And if you missed the first segment, we are talking to Tom Mesro. Tom Mesro, of course, of Michael Jackson fame and many, many other very large, high-profile cases. Tom is in studio with us. If you want to call us at 800-222-5222. That's 800-222-KABC. We're open to taking your questions or comments. Any questions you might have for Tom or me, Alan Gervie, right here at Gervie's Law. So, Tom, before the break, we talked briefly about Michael Jackson, and there were 14 counts of child molestation.
Well, it was 10 indicted felony counts. One of them was conspiracy. The rest of them related to allegations of child molestation. There was child molestation, there was attempted child molestation, and they charged him with four felony counts of allegedly giving alcohol to a victim to set the person up for child molestation. Very nasty indictment. At the end of the trial, the judge decided on his own motion that he was also going to give the jurors the option on the last four felony counts that if they acquitted him, they could consider a misdemeanor, which was giving alcohol to an underaged person.
Right.
The jury came back with 14 not guilties.
Incredible. So when you took on this case, didn't you think for a moment, what am I getting myself into? It's almost like a make or break point for you and your career.
Well, actually, close friends of mine said, don't do it. They said it's unwinnable. It's going to be the most watched trial in history.
Which it was.
Michael Jackson is the most famous person around the world. And you're not going to win. And for the rest of your life, anywhere you go in the world, people are going to say he's the one that sent Michael Jackson to prison. So
Right. They
warned me very, very sternly, don't take it. And I thought about what they said. And I said, look, this is who I am. This is what I do. And I'm not going to judge this person until I get to know him and look at the evidence. And, of course, the more I looked at the evidence, the more I realized this was baloney.
So this is an important point that all lawyers have to realize, that you have to separate the emotion from the facts. And in this case, while people may have been telling you, don't take the case, and, of course, you were, what, number three or number four attorney for Michael Jackson at the time?
No, I was originally asked to take the case, and I was defending actor Robert Blake in his high-profile homicide case. And I said no. And Johnny Cochran had recommended me to the Jacksons, which is very nice of him. I'll always be indebted to him for doing
sure.
that. And
Michael would be indebted to you, obviously.
Well, I said no because I was busy with the Blake case. And 4 months later, we started picking a jury in the Robert Blake case. And he and I had a falling out that the judge tried to resolve and couldn't. So in the middle of jury selection, I withdrew from the case, and Jackson's people called me again and said, we don't like our lawyers. We never did.
Right.
Would you be available now? And Randy Jackson wanted me to come to Florida to confidentially meet his brother and talk about it, and I did that.
So it begs the question again that if Blake, you had not had this falling out, you would not have represented Michael Jackson.
More than likely not, but I think they would have found they didn't like their lawyers. I took over the case 9 months before the jury trial started, and I think they would have found someone else because they told me they were very unhappy with who was representing him.
Which is another question all to itself, but I want to ask you about Robert Blake because, just briefly, is there a way you can tell us what the falling out was, or is that something that's going to be attorney-client privilege?
I really can't. I don't think it would be appropriate. I mean, Robert has actually written a book where he talks a little about it, but I don't think it's appropriate for me to comment, except that we had a strong difference of opinion. We met in the judge's chambers, just Robert, the judge, and I, and tried to straighten it out. We couldn't, and one thing led to another.
Do you think that it causes people to think that perhaps you thought he was guilty and didn't want to represent him from that point on?
That absolutely is not what happened. Robert has always maintained that he was innocent, never admitted guilt. It was an honor to defend him. I don't know if you remember, but there was a 3-week televised preliminary hearing where I got him bail in a murder with special circumstances case, which had never happened
before. That was the first time that had ever happened.
And it's never happened since, so for prosecution objection. But I think in that 3-week televised preliminary hearing, we turned public opinion around. We exposed the weaknesses in their case. And, you know, one thing led to another.
Okay, so if that's not the reason, do you ever consider in any other cases that you would drop out, and not in a specific case that we're talking about now, because you find you cannot defend a person who you believe is guilty?
Absolutely not. You have to understand the role the criminal defense lawyers play in America. And, you know, our courage and our energy and our ability to withstand public opinion when it's negative has resulted in more civil liberties among
Absolutely.
Our society than any other profession that I've ever seen. We do two things. We want to acquit innocent people. We want to stop abuse of power, and we want to make the system work.
Right.
If someone may be completely innocent, someone may be guilty of something but overcharged with offenses that they didn't commit, because prosecutors and police will abuse their power if you let them.
Right.
And we also make the system work. We make prosecutors and police prove their cases.
And, you know, for me as a trial attorney, I thoroughly agree with you because I'm in love with the law. I'm in love with what is right, not necessarily the facts of a case. I will work within the facts, but we have to look at the big picture. People don't understand that. As a criminal defense attorney or a trial attorney, doing whether you're doing workers' compensation cases or otherwise, you need to make sure that you're on the right side of justice.
Well, look, I could push you in a bar and be guilty of a misdemeanor assault, a simple assault.
Sure.
And a prosecutor will charge me with attempted murder to scare me into a plea bargain. That's abuse of power.
Absolutely.
Does that mean I'm not guilty of something? No. But does it mean that they abuse their authority? Yes, it does.
And doesn't it also mean that there are far-reaching implications for other people?
Of course there are. And if you let people abuse their power, they will continue to do it, and they will do it more and more and more. Criminal defense lawyers are the bulwark. We're the wall that stops that kind of thing from mushrooming and affecting the rest of us. And I think we've provide a very vital function. We're not always appreciated for what we do. We're not always liked for what we do. But unless we do our job vigorously and professionally, the system breaks down.
And if anyone is ever accused wrongly or accused of a crime that is far greater than that, what they may have committed, they will be thanking criminal lawyers like you because there is a process and because they aren't getting abused.
That, you know, again, people still ask me that question. Would you represent someone you thought was guilty or knew was guilty? And the answer is I could very, very likely do that because I do more than that. I also make the system work. If everyone doesn't do their job, the judge, the prosecutors, the defense attorneys, the witnesses under oath, the jurors under oath, everybody has to do their job in a professional way for this system to be the best system in the world, and it is.
Yeah, that makes total sense. Now, getting back finally with Michael Jackson, how did you get him off?
Well, I don't like the words get him off because I got up in my opening statement and I did something criminal defense lawyers rarely do. I didn't hide behind reasonable doubt. I didn't hide behind the presumption of innocence. I looked to the jury and I said, I'm going to prove to you that this man is innocent. And I'm going to do more than that. I'm going to make a contract with you. If I don't honor my contract and I don't prove to you he's innocent, you hold it against me at the end of the trial. I was so convinced this man was innocent and so convinced that their case was hogwash. And, you know, we took it one step at a time. Nobody really at the beginning believed we had a chance. And
but this was not all puffery. This was after you had done your due diligence on the facts and the witnesses, the evidence,
yes,
to come to this conclusion. People don't understand that.
Well, I had a wonderful investigator, Scott Ross. I had a great team of lawyers working with me. We all worked well, and we ended up winning a case that nobody thought we could. But we did it because we really exposed the truth in that courtroom. I mean, I had more good days cross-examining prosecution witnesses than I think I've ever had in my career. I mean,
right.
I kept putting on these phonies who just got exposed one after another. I likened it to bowling pins falling over.
I have to say something, that what you're saying, you're really being humble. I read an article that you wrote called Random Thoughts on Trial Practice. It's on your website, actually, at mesrolaw.com. It's www.mesrolaw.com. I'm urging, and I don't often do this, but I'm urging every lawyer and non-lawyer alike who is out there listening to the show right now to go to that website and click on the article called Random Thoughts on Trial Practice, because that is a brilliant article on advocacy and cross-examining, preparing witnesses, preparing your case, understanding it. And some of the things that you talk about in that, people just don't understand. They don't get it. Every lawyer, it should be required reading for every lawyer. When you talk about, one of the points you make in that article is that you prepared 20 binders to cross-examine a witness. Tell the folks right now what happened with those 20 binders.
Well, when I'm preparing for trial, I want every document that references a witness in chronological order so I can prepare to cross-examine that witness. Oh, if the documents are police reports, if they're transcripts, if they're newspaper articles, if they're handwritten notes by an investigator, whatever they are, I want them in chronological order. But you can prepare and prepare and prepare, but when you walk into a courtroom, you don't know what's going to happen. And what I was referring to was Michael Jackson's ex-wife, who the prosecution were announcing to everyone that she was going to just clobber Michael Jackson. I had 20 binders. I had every divorce paper from their family law proceeding. I had every interview she'd given, you name it. And when she got on the stand, I decided not to use any of them because lawyers get so invested in the preparation they do and the work they do that they don't want to let it go. You know, they just want to say, their attitude is, I did all this work. I prepared all these questions. I'm going to ask them.
And they're not thinking at the time what to do
when they're in trial. That's correct. You can't get too invested in your own ego and your own preparation. You have to respond to the moment. And I decided she was a good witness for us, and I wasn't going to attack her at all, and I never did.
Well, I'm going to respond in the moment because I know we're up against a break. You're listening to Tom Mesro. When we come back, we'll be taking your calls. We're going to talk more about Suge Knight. We'll talk about Jared Fogle. We'll talk about Charlie Sheen. We'll talk about anything that you want to talk about with the Tom Mesro, criminal attorney extraordinaire. I want to remind everyone, it's 800-222-5222, 800-222-5222. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KBC.
Fire on the 50th floor of the 100-story John Hancock Center in Chicago. It's under control now, but correspondent Ryan Young says there's still quite a scene.
Fire trucks and police personnel just about everywhere for about 5 or 6 blocks over. And, you know, the city blocks here are pretty huge.
A police officer was injured, taken to a hospital. The fire happened in a residential unit with smoke visibly billowing from the skyscraper. More than 500 flights canceled at 2 Chicago airports. As a pre-winter storm dumps heavy snow across the Midwest, the storm now moving northeast across Illinois, Indiana, and Michigan on its way to Canada. Are you driving a Tesla right now? Watch the seatbelt. It's causing a recall.
The global recall covers all 90,000 Model S electric cars. Owners are being asked to bring their cars in for an inspection of a bolt that attaches the seatbelt to the body of the vehicle. So far, no accidents or injuries have been reported. I'm Sierra Crawford.
College football final, number 12, North Carolina 30, Virginia Tech 27. I'm Michael Toscano.
Men, if you're like me, you appreciate the feeling of a clean, smooth shave from a quality blade. The sort of shave that cuts clean, without the burn. So why are you messing around with generic razors that cost $32 for an 8-pack when you can shave with Harry's high-quality German-engineered blades for half the price? And if saving money and a clean shave isn't incentive enough, Harry's will give you their starter set, complete with a razor, 3 of their world-famous blades, and shaving cream for just $15. And shipping is always free. We'll also give you $5 off your first order. Our way of saying thank you for trying us. How are we able to save you all this money and still give you the best shave you'll ever enjoy? By owning the factory that manufactures them. That's how. So go to Harry's.com right now and enter code 1414 at checkout. That's Harry's.com, code 1414.
Good morning, Mr. Spencer. I hope this email finds you well.
Hey, Donna.
What was that?
Your sleep.
My sleep? Where are you?
Good question. You look like crap, by the way.
Hey!
Just saying. I'd like to help, but you sleep on that busted pillow from college, and it's keeping me awake.
I'm sleeping.
Oh, so you meant to put on 2 different shoes this morning. Rear-end that cop. And call your boss Cheryl.
We're on a first-name basis.
His name is Larry.
Oh.
Get a MyPillow, Donna.
Your pillow?
No, MyPillow. It's a pillow customized to you, so it's yours. But it's called MyPillow because... Just get it.
Fine. Then we'll see how smart you are. Sleep.
Yes, we will. Person talking to invisible nothingness.
Try the adjustable, washable, incredibly comfortable MyPillow and get the sleep you've been missing, whether you know it or not.
Okay, let's regroup on Wednesday. Donna, get some sleep.
I'm on it, Cheryl. Make your pillow MyPillow.
Right now, buy one MyPillow and you'll receive your second MyPillow absolutely free. Go to MyPillow.com and enter promo code KABC or call 800-941-0262. Call today.
Need some legal, moral, or just common sense advice from a friend? Call Alan Gervie and Carrie Kasem now at 800-222-KABC. That's 800-222-5222.
Yes, indeed. You can call Alan or Tom Mesro, actually, not Carrie Kasem today. She's at the AMA Music Awards, and they're tomorrow night, and she's on the red carpet doing her interviews for Gervie's Law. Well, maybe not, but for another outlet, media outlet, and we wish her well in that endeavor. We have Tom Mesro, who is the criminal attorney who defended Michael Jackson. And he has represented, of course, Robert Blake. We spoke about Mike Tyson and others. He's representing Suge Knight. We're going to get to Suge Knight in a minute. But first, I want to ask you, Tom, this week we saw some news. We heard about Jared Fogle, for instance. You know, obviously, you've had a lot of experience with the child molestation cases. people have said, why did Jared Fogle only get 15 and a half years, although it was more than what the prosecution actually requested of the judge?
Well, based on my experiences in California, he was pretty lucky.
Yeah.
Because when you have that number of alleged victims and you are convicted, they throw the book at you in this state.
You know,
I think he's fortunate.
I think you're right. And I think a lot of attorneys have been a little bit outraged who work mostly, obviously, in the prosecution. Why he would get 15 and a half years where people like, let's say, Jerry Sandusky gets what effectively is going to be a life sentence.
Well, I think a deal was cut. And I think you have to always remember in child molestation cases, the prosecutors are always concerned about the welfare of the alleged victims. And very often, these kids don't want to come into court. They're embarrassed. They're scared. Their parents don't want them to come into court. And so they will make plea bargains and cut deals that are designed to spare the families of those who've been victimized from the ordeal of going into court. And that give and take goes on before trial. And I suspect that there was concern that these young kids would be very, very hurt, very upset, their families upset if they had to go through a long, drawn-out trial and cross-examination.
And don't you think that was probably a good move for Jared as well?
Sounds to me like he got a, you know, given what he's been convicted of, I think he's pretty fortunate.
Would that have been a case that you might have taken on?
I mean, I keep an open mind. You know, I don't just let public opinion sway me. I think good criminal defense lawyers are skeptics by nature.
Yeah.
We don't just let headlines and newspaper reports and public innuendo guide us. We have to look at things ourselves and make up our own minds ourselves as to what we're dealing with. So would I have been willing to talk to someone like him? Yeah, sure. I'm a criminal defense lawyer. You know?
You talk to anyone who deserves a justice and an attorney.
I think every citizen in America deserves a vigorous, compelling defense. That's how our system works, and that kind of approach, I think, results in the most fairness.
In March of 2015, this year, you wrote a column regarding Jerry Sandusky saying Michael Jackson's, it's called Michael Jackson's Lawyer Thinks Sandusky Case Merits a Second Look.
Well, I don't know Mr. Sandusky. I don't know what happened. I had some concerns about issues that I had been reported to me about how fast the judge pushed that trial, what some of the witnesses' backgrounds were. I was concerned about the way Penn State handled the situation. And so I looked into it just from my own vantage point.
Right.
I don't know what happened. And I say that in the article. I don't know what happened between Mr. Sandusky and these alleged victims. But some things about the case concerned me. They just didn't seem right. And I think someone like he should get a fair shot when he's charged with something this horrendous. And as you said, he's basically going to spend his life in prison. And you shouldn't give life in prison to anyone unless they are given the fundamental fairness that our Constitution guarantees.
And when they talk about Penn State, things turning around for Joe Paterno, for instance, getting his wins reinstated. Something happened afterwards, and Penn State was off the hook, so to speak.
Yeah, a lot of it seems very suspicious to me at a distance. I'm in California. This is all happening in Pennsylvania. So the way things played out, something just didn't smell right to me about the way this trial was conducted. It almost seemed like a bit of a railroad. Now, maybe he's guilty. I don't know.
Right. Do you think he'll have another opportunity to tell his story?
I'm told by some people close to the action, yes, that things are falling his direction, you know, on the appellate level.
Yeah.
So we'll see.
Yeah.
We'll see.
We'll take an interest in that because I read that article and I thought that you're not saying one way or another, but there are issues and questions that need to be explored.
You know, we've seen over 200 people released from life sentences, death sentences, long prison sentences because of DNA. What happened during those years when we didn't have DNA to examine and to link to other forms of evidence? I mean, can you imagine how many innocent people were destroyed and their families destroyed because there was no DNA to examine?
Right.
I mean, we have to be very careful. Our system is the best system in the world, bar none, but it's not perfect.
Exactly.
And mistakes are made and lives are ruined. So we have to be as vigilant as possible at every level of the system to make sure that the maximum amount of fairness and justice and equity comes out.
And, you know, it's interesting because not too long back, we had F. Lee Bailey on the show. We had Alan Dershowitz on the show. This was when we were commemorating O.J. Simpson trial 20th anniversary. And they both said the same thing, especially F. Lee Bailey. I mean, he believes O.J. is not guilty, and he believes that if anyone jumps to conclusions, we're ruining the system. Forget about just O.J. Mm-hmm.
Well, a lot of white people, unfortunately, like to reduce that whole case to race. And race did play a major issue in the case. Remember, this was not long after the Rodney King riots, you know, were in Los Angeles,
right,
which were the worst urban riots in American history. The LAPD had a strong history of racism, you know, leading up to that trial. So race did play a major role, but not the only role. You know, the forensic attack by Barry Scheck and Peter Neufeld was brilliant.
Yeah.
I mean, the defense attacked the blood splatter evidence. They attacked the DNA evidence. They attacked the way the crime scene was processed, the way evidence was collected, the way it was treated at the lab. They attacked lab procedures at the LAPD. And after that verdict, police labs around the country began spending fortunes to upgrade their facilities so this kind of thing wouldn't happen again. And we have to be vigilant, and criminal defense attorneys have to do their job. They have to challenge.
Although they don't always feel the best after the fact. F. Lee Bailey said to me, that was an experience that I could have well done without.
Mm-hmm.
We have a caller here, Renee from Thousand Oaks. Welcome to Gervie's Law.
Hi. I have a question for Mr. Mesereau. I was wondering if you've ever taken a case and then after learning more about your client, ever regretted it.
Hey, interestingly, well, we just talked about that with F. Lee Bailey. Now we'll hear from Tom Mesereau.
Well, I've taken cases that I regretted taking because the experience of dealing with certain clients was not terribly positive. But I've never taken a case where a further examination of the evidence made me want to get out. I don't believe in that. I believe that a criminal lawyer has to be present and a criminal defense attorney has to do their job to make justice work. But I have had cases where the clients turned out to be very, very difficult people to deal with. I've had some cases where I had a strong intuition, you don't want to represent this person because they're going to be impossible to deal with. Nothing's going to please them. They haven't gotten along with lawyers before. I've had those experiences, but never did I want to pull out because suddenly I thought somebody was guilty. That hasn't happened.
Renee, thanks for the call. Clint is in Sherman Oaks. Clint, welcome to Gervie's Law.
Hi, thanks, Alan. I have a question for Mr. Mesereau.
Sure.
Mr. Mesereau, you have a very distinct appearance, and you've handled some very high-profile cases where your clients were accused of heinous things. When you go out in public, do you get a welcome reception from people, or do you get any harassment from people who disagree with the results you've obtained for your clients?
You know, generally, I don't get too much harassment. You know, after the Michael Jackson verdict, all kinds of people, you know, young, middle-aged, old, people of all races and occupations were coming up and congratulating me because they felt almost relieved that he was vindicated. I did, however, I remember I spoke to a bar association one evening, and I came out of the restaurant where the meeting took place, and I got in my car, and I was driving out, and some guy screamed at me, "What molester did you get off this week?" You know, so
wow.
You can't please everybody, but I've been treated pretty well. I've been fortunate.
Thanks for the call, Clint. And I want to talk before our break about Charlie Sheen. It's been in the news all week. There's a lot of theories coming out whether there will be lawsuits filed. In fact, I believe Gloria Allred contacted our show and said something that she may have been contacted. She wouldn't make any comment, of course, by victims, and I don't know if that's the proper word or not, of Charlie Sheen's sexual encounters after the HIV diagnosis. What is your take on that?
Well, this whole thing is a tragedy to me. To see someone that talented and that blessed with opportunities in life, you know, just kind of go down the drain like this is very troubling to me. Clearly, with the fame and the money, he got carried away. His lifestyle got reckless, I think.
Right.
And I don't like to see anybody go down in flames like this. It's very sad. Do I think there are going to be a lot of lawsuits? Yes, I do. I think, first of all, Los Angeles is a very litigious community, and the Hollywood community is very litigious as well. And people are always angling to put some money in their pocket. So
right.
I think you're going to see a lot of lawsuits. Some of them may have credibility, and some of them probably won't, where people are going to say, well, he told me that he was not infected. He told me that he did not have any venereal disease, and I've been defrauded, and I've been misled,
right,
and I've suffered distress. I think you're going to see a lot of that happen.
So explain to the audience what the difference between a misdemeanor and a felony under these circumstances is regarding intent.
Well, I don't see him being charged with a crime. I mean, nothing that I've heard suggests he's going to be charged with a crime. In California, if you intentionally have sex with someone knowing that you have the AIDS virus, for example, and you intend to hurt them, that can be a serious, serious felony offense.
And that's the key that people don't understand. What you just said, you intend to hurt
right.
them. That is almost impossible to prove under these circumstances.
And I don't think he really operated that way. I certainly hope he didn't. I think the main arena is going to be civil court, not criminal court.
And what about these extortion claims that people said, pay me off so I don't open my mouth?
I don't doubt that went on. And apparently he did pay a lot of money to people to try and keep this quiet. I'd be curious to know why all of a sudden he decided I'm going to go public as opposed to the position he was taking, which was I'm going to buy silence.
Apparently he wanted to save some money for his five kids and his one granddaughter by going public to eliminate the extortion claims. Yeah.
Okay. Well, the whole thing is sad. I don't get any pleasure out of seeing someone hurt like this and go down in flames like this. And I hope he lives a productive, healthy life, and I hope his family's okay.
And I agree. You know, as lawyers, we like to put things behind us. If we're representing a client, you do your best, you do whatever happens, happens, then you move on. It's not something that needs to stay in the public eye.
Sure.
People have a right to live their life the way they choose without the harassment that the media and money seems to play in these cases.
I agree with you wholeheartedly.
Well, we're going to come back. When we come back, what a lot of folks have been listening for is to hear about the Suge Knight case. We're going to talk in our last segment. Tom Mesro represents Suge Knight, and you don't want to miss that. We're going to be back. You're listening to Gervie's Law. We're talking to Tom Mesro. I'm Alan Gervie right here on Talk Radio 790 KBC.
Any person who makes or causes to be made any knowingly false or fraudulent material statement or material representation for the purposes of obtaining workers' compensation benefits is guilty of a felony.
Another day at work. The pain is getting worse, and I'm afraid to say anything because I need this job, and I don't want to get fired. If I wasn't the only one supporting the family, I'd quit.
Is this you? Are you suffering every day while your injuries get worse, and there seems to be nowhere to turn? Or do you have an injury that was brought on gradually by repetitive motion, and now you can't perform your job duties at all? For over 35 years, the law firm of Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn has represented those who have sustained an injury on the job or have become disabled as a result of work. They're the experts in workers' compensation. You need an advocate. You need someone who cares about the injured worker. You need the law firm of Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn to get you through the nightmare. Friends, if you're suffering with a cumulative work injury, the law firm of Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn is in business to help you. Find out more. Call the law firm of Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn, 855-4-RGW-LAW. That's 855-4-RGW-LAW. Or go to rgwlawfirm.com. First consultations are free.
This Black Friday, don't stand in line to save a buck. Listen to KBC and win some bucks. $100 to be exact. Just be the ninth caller when you hear the cue to call. All day Friday from 6 to 6. And score a $100 gift card to the Team LA store, your LA Kings holiday headquarters. But wait, there's more. Qualify for a $1,000 shopping spree at the end of the season. Whoa, that sure beats camping out all night in the freezing cold for a busted toaster. It's a Black and Silver Friday on 790 KABC. You see?
You've heard of Murphy's Law, but have you heard of Gervie's Law? Anything that can go wrong can be made right. Now, here are your hosts, Carrie Kasem and Alan Gervie.
Yes, and they're teasing Carrie Kasem on there. Carrie Kasem isn't here. She's at the AMA Music Awards in L.A., getting ready for the big show tomorrow night. So we'll hear about that next week on our Thanksgiving show, where we have attorneys from the Los Angeles charities, the Trial Lawyers Charities, which will be appropriate for Thanksgiving. And today, of course, we have Tom Mesro, who has done yeoman's work for pro bono causes and for helping people who don't have the ability to help themselves, something that I know he is proud of. He goes to Alabama, what is it, every year, and you take on a case, And I know you, you're with Charles Salvaggio, who's an Alabama attorney.
That's right.
And how do you choose a capital case that you're going to defend?
Well, I've been doing this for the last 18 years. All my cases except one have been in Alabama. I did one in Mississippi. I'm someone who likes to see things for myself. In fact, I'll share this with you. My first semester in law school, I dropped out because I thought of being a journalist. And I had this fantasy of traveling around the world, going from one hot spot to another, and seeing for myself what was really going on. I thought about it and went back to law school, and, you know, the rest is history for me. But nevertheless, I want to see things myself. I'd always heard a lot of criticism about the way the death penalty was handled in the southern states.
Right.
And I didn't want to just base my knowledge on books. I wanted to do it myself. I got a call, I guess it was 18, 19 years ago, from someone who I had a lot of respect for, who said there's a high-profile death penalty case in Birmingham, Alabama. A homeless black man has been charged with murdering a beautiful white girl from a prominent family. It's getting a tremendous amount of press. The defense lawyers have been getting death threats. There were messages, there were nigger lovers, that kind of thing.
Right.
And they'd like to meet you. And I said I'd love to meet them, so I flew on my own dime to Birmingham. I met Charles Salvaggio and another lawyer named Wilson Myers, and I agreed to help them with the case. And our client was acquitted. There was a lot of commotion after it. The family was furious. The father had to be escorted from the courtroom by sheriffs.
The victim's family.
Yeah. The father of a lovely girl. She was studying to get a paralegal degree. And there was a lot of anger directed at me for coming in from California and helping them.
Yeah.
And
the hired gun, although you weren't taking any money for
it. No money. I've never gotten a dime to handle any of these cases. And I've done, in the 20s.
And isn't it true that none of them have been given the death penalty?
That's correct.
Amazing. You know, I wish we had more time to talk about that because that's intriguing for a lawyer like me to hear that sort of thing. But I want to talk about the Suge Knight case. Now, you are, I believe, the fourth attorney for Suge Knight. As an attorney, when I'm the third or fourth attorney on a case, sometimes it's problematic for me because I look at what other attorneys have done, whether in the media or otherwise, and think, how am I going to put Humpty Dumpty together again?
Well, I was asked repeatedly to take the case. Twice I said no. I was very busy with other matters. And then I said to myself, you know, you're the guy who always says don't judge a book by its cover. You got to get deep into who people are and what the facts are. And I spent 2 days with Suge, and I came out of those 2 days saying, this man is not the one that's being portrayed.
Yeah.
And what I discovered was that he grew up on the streets of Compton. You know, things were not always easy, particularly if you were big. You had to defend yourself, or else everybody would be all over you.
Right.
But this man had high grades in high school, went to college on an athletic scholarship, had very high grades, was a star athlete. Played for the LA Rams, was on his way to play with the 49ers, and decided to open his own business and became a world famous, successful businessman.
Very successful.
Creative, inventive. He's very bright. But I also learned that unlike other successful people in this rap industry, he never abandoned his community. He was supporting families whose sons have been killed in drive-by shootings. He would have a banquet in Beverly Hills every year for single moms from Compton who were up against it and raising their kids and doing a wonderful job. He would help so many people so often. He built athletic facilities for high school kids, for grammar school kids. And I realize there's a side of Suge Knight that people just don't know, and that maybe he didn't want them to know because he was promoting a business concept, you know, the rap industry.
And, you know, a lot of us are like that. I mean, I'm not comparing myself to Suge Knight, of course, but there's a lot of things about us, attorneys, for instance, that are personal, and they'll remain personal.
Sure.
But it doesn't mean that there isn't a side that people don't know about.
And, you know, he was never jumped into a gang. I mean, and he generated a lot of jealousy.
Did you see the movie Straight Outta Compton?
I did.
And your opinion?
Well, I think it's a very entertaining film, but a lot of it's fiction. And, of course, they intentionally went out of their way to demonize Suge Knight in the movie, but it's fiction. You know, it's not true.
But
we're going to get into a courtroom, and a jury's going to be under oath, and they're going to find out what the facts are.
And that's true, because there's lawsuits that have been filed by certain individuals who feel they were defamed.
Yeah, to me it was entertainment, nothing else.
Is there anything on Suge's part that he would want to file a civil suit against the producers of that movie?
Not to my knowledge, no. I think Suge is not worried about the movie. I'm not worried about it. It's just entertainment, a lot of exaggeration, a lot of fiction. They thought they would help sales by demonizing him, and it is what it is. It's not reality, and it's not truth.
So I know you can't talk about all of the issues involved in the Suge Knight case, but tell us a little bit about where we are, because I know there's a hearing coming up. They had given you more time as the fourth attorney to get up to speed.
Yes.
What do you expect to happen in December at this hearing?
Not very much. We just got a lot of discovery from the prosecution. We're examining everything they gave us. Our investigators are out finding witnesses and discovering the facts, and I don't think you'll see any trial till next year.
Till next year.
Yes.
And when we see the trial, what will you be looking at in terms of jury selection?
Well, I'm going to keep that quiet. But let me tell you this. It's been very interesting because you've seen that tape on the news where Suge is in his truck and he's attacked viciously.
Right.
And he runs for his life. A lot of conservative white people who don't like rap music and don't particularly like the image of Suge Knight have told me I would have done the same thing. Why are they charging him?
And in fact, we see it a lot on the streets of L.A. every day. I have to tell you, just this past week, my wife and I were driving on Oxnard Boulevard, right in North Hollywood. We were turning into an auto body shop, and a car came up to us, and I kind of put up my hands like, what are you doing? The guy pulled a gun from the side of the passenger side and pointed it at me. My heart started beating. I drove off, obviously, as fast as I could, and fortunately, everything was okay. But when you talk about what goes on, there are a lot of issues that we see in driving, and people react in ways, you know, when I saw this, obviously, you know, I'm not the tough guy, but I had to get out of there.
Well, when you got out of there, if you had accidentally run over someone and they lost their life, can you imagine being charged with murder?
I can't. I mean, that's the whole point. That these things happen, and it's self-perseverance, preserving what you have, your family and everything. And I have two little children who weren't in the car, thankfully, at the time. But, you know, these are issues that are going to come up in the Suge Knight
case. They definitely will.
We talk about anger, how does that play a role in these cases? I mean, what if the prosecutor is saying that Suge reached a boiling point, did something that he shouldn't have done?
Well, I think they're going to try and say something like that. And the fact is that he knew who these people were. He knew the neighborhood. He knew the location. And he knew that people were trying to ambush him and kill him. And they had tried it before. And he ran for his life. And that's what happened.
Now, he's in jail right now. There's a $10 million bond. Is that correct?
Yes.
What was this business with Floyd Mayweather? Was that all just media hype when he said he was going to pay the $10 million to get Suge out of prison?
In my opinion, it was media hype because it never happened.
Obviously, it didn't happen.
No.
Now, is this a situation from your perspective that you believe that someone who is accused of murder should have the ability to get out on bail?
Well, of course they should, particularly in a ridiculous case like this. And I really believe it's ridiculous, you know, because he was alone. He never got out of his truck, even though somebody was striking him through the window. And that person testified they tried to get the car keys. They tried to get the gear shift. I mean, come on. You know, you see other people patrolling that location. It's very obvious to me what happened, and we'll have to let the jury know this is what the truth is.
And you feel confident at this point that when the facts come out, that everyone will realize that this is not a murder trial.
I am very confident about that.
Are there any proceedings that can take place before a full-blown jury trial that will actually acquit him of any liability?
I mean,
or
anything can happen in the criminal justice system,
yeah.
But probably not. I think you know, it's like the train leaves the station and nobody knows how to put the brakes on. I think the DAs have committed to the case and now they're stuck with it. That's how I see it.
And you remain committed to following through with whatever it takes.
Yes, I do.
Well, you know, we take our hats off to you for that because, you know, there's a lot of people who rush to judgment when they see things on TV. And you have made a lot of comments in different publications on television that the media has a large role in shaping the opinions of people. Outside of the facts.
They do, but American juries are notoriously independent. When people take the oath that they will follow the judge's instructions and look at the facts and try and do what's right, they take it very seriously. The media said Robert Blake would be acquitted. He wasn't. They said O.J. Simpson would be. Pardon me. They said Robert Blake would be convicted. He wasn't.
Right.
They said that O.J. Simpson would be convicted. He wasn't. They said Michael Jackson would be convicted. He wasn't. So don't underestimate the independence and the courage and the honesty of American juries.
And the concept of reasonable doubt. I know Alan Dershowitz talked about this on our show quite a bit about reasonable doubt, that people don't understand that concept.
Right. Right. But it's a bedrock of our justice system. And remember, our country places much more value on liberty and reputation than it does on money or property. You know, it's harder to convict someone in criminal court than to beat someone in civil court, because we place such a high value on freedom and reputation.
And that makes a lot of sense. What a great way to end this wonderful show, Gervie's Law. Tom Mesro, you're at mesrolaw.com. If anyone wants to really look at a great, great website with so much information, go to mesrolaw.com. Tom, I want to thank you for being here at Gervie's Law this week.
Thank you, Alan. It's really been an honor.
We hope to have you back another time, talk a lot more about the theories behind the law. You're listening to Gervie's Law. Next week, we have our Thanksgiving show. Don't forget to listen. 2 p.m. on Saturday next week. I'm Alan Gervie. Have a great weekend. Thanks for listening to